Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, this is Jackie Cation, and you are about to listen to the Dork Forest since 2006. And it is on iTunes, of course, where you may have received it. You may have gotten it at dorkforest.com. Feel free to review it on iTunes. We are part of the All Things Comedy Network, allthingscomedy.com, where my new hour special, This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux, is available for $5 download. Knock yourselves out. My website, JackieCation.com, has a player if you want to just listen to it and you don't want to do iTunes. And JackieCation.com has everything. It has my stand-up schedule. It has a merch page where you can get Dork Forest t-shirts and even order a Dork Forest hoodie if you like. All of the shirts are made in America because while I'm willing to wear clothing that are made by toddlers, I'm unwilling to sell clothing made by toddlers. The hoodie, special ordered, for some reason, still made in the Philippines. I don't know why. Possibly because they're super cozy and I don't sell that many of them, but I should work on that. Anyway, there's a chance to donate to the Dork Forest. If you enjoy the Dork Forest, feel free to donate. $100 a year makes you a super fan, and you could do that in one chunk of $100, or you could break it up however you want, because I have not made that easy for you. It would be $8.33 a month if you want to do it. You could also just order stuff if you want Dork Forest t-shirts or CDs or DVD. I have 3 CDs out and 1 DVD, and you can order all of them. You could order a t-shirt, you could order a hoodie, and that will also support the show, and I totally appreciate that. Yeah, just so you know, the DVD of the Horcrux is Friday Second Show. That is the video. And the CD is Saturday Second Show. I don't know. I didn't videotape that one, but I like that set better. So that is the CD. The DVD is approximately 56 minutes long, and the CD, about 40, 48. So they're different sets, but they're the same material. And it's weird, but I like it. The credits. Let's credit the people that make this show possible, quite honestly. We have Mike Rickberg, who sang the intro song and composed the intro song and sings it with his girlfriend, Sarah Cohen, and he will sing Mexican Hat Dance at the end of this. The audio is fixed every week, and the teasers are created by Mr. Patrick Brady, friend of the show. Vilmos does my website, JackieCation.com. So if you're looking for someone to do your website, go to JackieCation.com, scroll down, and click on that link. All right, let's do this. Enjoy. At RBC Wealth Management, social responsibility starts at the top. As a part of the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC has been recognized among the world's financial, social, and environmental corporate leaders. Our sense of responsibility extends to our reputation for putting clients' interests first. My personal commitment is to help you achieve your financial goals by also considering sustainable and responsible investing strategies. To learn more, visit www.darlacashian.com. RBC Wealth Management, a division of RBC Capital Markets, LLC. Member NYSE, FINRA, SIPC. Hello and welcome to the Dork Forest, you guys. We are at ACON 25, Dallas, Texas, here at the Hotel Anatole. Please clap.
Wow.
Oh my God, it worked.
That much noise from that many people, I'm impressed.
Who knew it would work? Yeah. And it totally worked. I'm sitting here with Helen McCarthy. You are a dork luminary. A luminary of the Dork Forest, as far as I'm concerned.
That's very funny.
Helen McCarthy, are you on the Twitter?
Of course.
And what is your Twitter handle?
Well, my Twitter handle is very complicated. I tried all the possible combinations of my name and my initials, but there are just too many Helen McCarthy's in this world. Most of them much more talented and much better paid than I am, which is annoying. So on Twitter, I am TweetHeart4711.
That's right. You're the TweetHeart.
Mm-hmm. I am TweetHeart of the Forces.
You're the UK TweetHeart.
Yep.
You're now America's TweetHeart, because here we are.
And here we are indeed.
Indeed. Now, so what was the number on the end of it?
4711.
4711. Does that mean something?
There's a deep significance in that. No, really. There's an 18th century cologne recipe that's produced actually in the town of Cologne, which is numbered 4711. on its original patent.
We have begun as we mean to go forth. I approve of that story.
Historical smells that don't turn your stomach.
Excellent. Well played, Helen McCarthy. I am so excited. Here's how we met. I don't know if you remember how we met.
Well, I remember how we met.
Wait, what's your version?
We met at breakfast.
Yep.
And we actually hadn't spent the night together beforehand. And this is so rare for me.
You are working it, lady. Well played. Well played. Are you a single lady?
It depends.
Okay.
I have been devoted.
Is it complicated?
No, it's not complicated at all. I have been devotedly attached to the love of my life for 33 years now.
Okay.
That's the person who's responsible for getting me into anime. But I always think that in human life, there's a continuum of everything. And therefore, I'm always open to offers.
Okay. Oh, you're always available to possibly receive from the universe, let's say.
What the universe gives, I accept.
All right. I like it. I'm confused. I was just wondering if you were getting laid, is I guess what I was really...
I'm getting laid at home, and I'm getting laid occasionally elsewhere.
Abroad?
Nobody can complain about that.
And no one
abroad
can...
Abroad is what I really like.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a man with a giant sword who knows he does not belong in the Dork Forest. And yet, kind of does belong in the Dork Forest.
Doesn't he? He wants something better. He aspires to something beyond.
He does aspire to something beyond. It's,
I mean, just being...
Oh, right.
Which dirty movies?
It's Funimation after this, right? Which is 18 and over. They're short animated things that people submit, and they're either filthy or super, super dark, right? A little mean, little, you know, a man and a child walk into the forest, and the child says, "This is very scary," and the man says, "You think it's scary? I got to walk out of here alone." So that sort of they're a little incesty.
Actually,
they can
The sad thing I think about most porn, but definitely about anime porn, is that most of it is so fucking tedious.
Well played.
I mean, it's the same thing.
What is that thing? So that I don't have to sit through it.
Well,
it's what I'm saying.
Essentially, it's guy meets girl, and it's almost always guy meets girl unless you're in BL.
What's BL?
Boys love.
Boys love. Oh, yeah. Boy on boy crime? Boy
on
boy love?
We like boy
on
boy.
All right.
It's essentially someone meets someone fucks someone, someone fucks some more, then the milkman gets involved.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just very
some
curious.
Sort of third party. It's, UPS shows up with a box, and he's like, "There's something for you in the box," and it's his dick. Okay, fair enough. I've only heard about porn. I haven't watched a lot of porns. I've only heard 25 years.
Nobody actually watches a lot of porn. Most people go to sleep after the first 10 minutes.
Oh, that is also what I've been told, is that nobody's seen an entire porn.
No.
Okay, all right. Because what about closure? What about the wedding? Like a Harlequin romance, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever read any Harlequin. Have you read any Harlequin romances? You're not missing a whole lot. When I was 12, 13, used to read a lot of Harleys. That's what I called them. Yeah. Called them Harleys. And, at the end of it, they kiss. They get married and there's some kissing. Barbara Cartland. She was another one who would do that.
Oh yeah.
And, the kissing was like the last fucking paragraph. And, you're like, I'm 13. I need some actual, is there any physicality at all?
Yeah, I need some information here.
Right.
I need something I can use.
You are not getting any from a Barbara Cartland novel.
Well, to be fair, some of the later Cartlands shaded a little more into experience, but no, she wasn't of the era that believed she should be telling you what to do. To her credit, she was non-prescriptive.
What do you mean?
She didn't tell you what you ought to do and with whom.
Okay.
She just left it to your imagination.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. Like, who, after they got married, was it man, was it BL?
Well, you have to remember that a Victorian household had an awful lot of servants in it.
Oh. I wish I knew what that meant. I've spent the entire weekend doing that. I wish I knew why they were laughing.
The thing is, if you marry into a really, really rich family, it has all kinds of resources of which you can then avail yourself.
Okay. Oh, some loosey-goosey action happening.
Yeah, husbands, brothers, stable hands, footmen, you know, the kind
of thing. Upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anywhere you like.
All right. Anywhere. See, because what I remember, do you remember when we met? It was at breakfast.
Yes.
And I don't know who I was talking to, and I mentioned Georgette Heyer, and someone asked me who she was, and I said, she's sort of the poor man's Jane Austen. And you turned around and said, Georgette Heyer is the poor man's no one.
Yes.
And then I was like, please be on the Dork Forest.
Yeah, my fellow writers are always worth defending, but she's someone that I have loved since I was 9 years old and read my first novel by her. She's a Regency novelist, as you say, not Jane Austen, but a wonderful Regency novelist who is witty, humane, compassionate. Right, sharp as a knife, understands how to plot, doesn't waste anybody's time.
Yeah, seriously, just as novels, I like her better than Jane Austen, only because they're tighter. They're just, she's the arc on them, they're about 220, which is a nice length for a novel that you want to be sitting around reading, in 4 days, if you take your time and don't skim.
And I've never understood why they haven't been filmed.
Yeah, they would
they
be the,
are so.
Yeah, like E.M. Forster. Am I saying that correct? Yeah. Is that am I pronouncing that?
Yeah.
Room with a View.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
I mean, they would be so popular on TV because they have the best heroes and the sparkiest, spunkiest, silliest heroines.
Yeah, the heroines are, they're usually very smart and they're not lame in any way, shape, or form. She doesn't have a lame character in any of her books. The worst of her novels is that one, I think it's The Conquistador.
Yes.
But it's because I don't get it. It's like it's this dense historical fiction set in Spain and in England, and it's just gothic.
Well, the trouble with The Conquistador is that she was in love with early history. Her favorite era was the 14th century in England. The last book she wrote, which she never finished, was called My Lord John and was set in that era. But it wasn't the milieu that suited her best. Many of us as writers have things we wish we could do, the things we wish we were good at. And she really, really wanted to be good at that kind of historical fiction. And I'm not saying that she was bad at it. She was just so supernaturally brilliant at the Regency romance. But really, it was all, we resent her doing anything.
Right. That is super, because she loved, you could clearly tell that she loved the era and her history was dead on and she knew all the extraneous weirdo personalities in all of Regency England. And she had a knowledge of the political history where the regent himself sounded like a mess. Of a human being.
Yeah.
And he was just like, nah, I'm going to build this weird. He created the idea of a folly, which is just, I'm going to build a bridge over a hill. There's no river there, but when I look out the window, I want to see a bridge.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's no river there.
They used to do things like, oh, well, I've got this really untidy old Gothic ruin in my garden, so I'm going to pull it down and spend a lot of money on building a nice modern fake Gothic ruin.
Exact, dead on.
In the same place, yeah?
Yeah.
They were mad. They were all crazy.
Out of their minds. Except for that I was once at the, in Delphi, in Greece, and I thought I was at the Oracle. I don't think I was. I don't know where I was, but it was ruins, right? And there was an American businessman who was also going through these ruins with me, and he said, you know, the weird thing about this is they know what it looked like, but they don't fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the weird thing.
That's it. My husband works for the royal household, and he occasionally has cause to go up to Windsor Castle and tells me that there is a wall with scratches on it that are scored through. And people ask what they are, and if the people who ask are not American, they say, that's a tally of every American who asks us why they built the castle so close to the damn airport.
Yeah, that's a pity.
Yeah, they're almost running out of wool.
Wow, it just makes me proud. Anyway,
Well, you don't need to know history, do you?
No.
I mean, you don't have much of it yet, so, you know, what?
Right, we're just babies.
Yeah.
We're babies.
Infant empire.
Except for that when you look at the Australians, one of my favorite things about the Australians is that if you tell them, like, they should apologize to the Aboriginals, for example, the Australians are like, we don't want to. And then someone will go, yeah, but we should. And you go, fine. We're sorry. And Americans are like, we don't want to. And then that is the end of the conversation, sadly.
Yes, yes.
And it would be nice if, like, the sort of the super, you know, angry sort of, I don't know if it's right wing or even super left wing. They're like, man, that's the way it ought to be, man.
Yeah.
It's what happened.
Well, in fact, the Aboriginal people of Australia are going to be the only people around after the nuclear holocaust because they'll be the only people who know how to survive it. So. They'll have the last laugh on all of us.
Oh, because they know how to survive in the middle of Australia?
Yeah, they know how to survive in the middle of this baking hot environment with nothing to eat and no water and absolutely nowhere to shelter. They'll be fine.
They might be. They might be. Have you ever seen, I don't know why I'm digressing, but have you ever seen a movie, a television program?
Why not digress?
Let's do it. Let's weed off into Survivor Man. There's a TV show called Survivor Man, Canadian dude. He's a Canadian man who goes, brings his own three camera setup into the wilderness, and then he gives himself a week to, he drops himself in the middle of nowhere, and then gets himself out of the situation, gets to the rendezvous. And there was one place where he was in the desert, and, we're watching it with a friend who was Mexican, and he was like, I have to eat scorpions or something like that. And, she was like, no, there's a cactus that's edible right behind you. Why aren't you eating the?
Yeah, but he's Canadian. They don't have cacti in Canada.
Well, I have to have protein somehow. Let's eat scorpions. Let's have a half a dozen of these.
Actually, being Canadian, I think he'd have real problems eating anything alive because he'd spent so long apologizing and asking if it was convenient at the moment.
Is it okay? Are you guys all right?
Yeah, I love Canadians. Of course, Canada is still part of the British Empire, voluntarily.
Voluntarily.
Yes, absolutely voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And we make allowances for the French part because we've been making allowances to the French for several years.
I had a Canadian dork on the Dork Forest. I had someone who was an American who loves Canadian politics and Canadian history. And he explained that eventually it was the British Empire who said, no, you guys seriously have to move out.
Yeah.
And we just
need the room.
We don't have time. I mean, no, you actually don't have to ask us to do anything. You can just do things. You're your own country. Go forth. And it was like 1952.
Yeah.
Which is very sad.
Yeah.
I think they like the outfits.
Yeah, I think they do. But then it's not nearly as bad as Swiss womanhood. Swiss women didn't get the vote till the mid 1990s.
What? Switzerland?
Yeah.
Wait, next to Austria and Holocaust money?
Yeah.
All right.
No, Swiss women didn't get the vote until the mid-1990s, and some Swiss men allegedly said they'd never needed the vote because no Swiss man would ever be stupid enough to vote in any way that didn't suit his wife.
Oh, there you go. That's just good writing.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, okay, so you have written 10 nonfiction books about the history of anime. 12 now. All right.
Yeah.
I sadly have read none of them.
Oh.
And I've seen Dragon Ball Z.
You have that pleasure still to come.
Exactly. That's what I like to think. That's because now I get to learn about it. So anime.
And manga.
And manga. Okay. All right. They are together because manga came first?
Manga definitely came first, just as comic books came before cartoons in America.
Okay.
Because manga was the cheapest and most readily available form of entertainment that was popular with all levels of society in Japan from a very early stage. But modern manga is quite a different thing. Until really Japan opened up to the West, manga were satirical pictures, popular pictures, cheap pulp pictures, the sort of entertainment that you got. Yeah, some porn.
Okay.
A bit of porn.
Right.
But also pin-ups of popular actors, views of famous scenes, the kind of things you buy as souvenirs on your holidays, you know.
Okay.
Here's a picture of a famous landmark that I went to see.
Okay.
So if you were the sort that wanted to swank about how far you traveled,
you'd
paper the walls of your house with beautiful woodcut prints of the 101 temples of the Shikoku Circuit or whatever.
And that was manga?
And that was considered manga. But
okay.
Because manga as a term was coined in probably the early 1700s. Great American scholar Adam Kern locates it first in 1728 in a novel by Japan's first professional novelist. But it doesn't start having the meaning that we give it today until you get into really the mid-1870s.
Oh, really? Yeah. Like were people bringing it back to the West in the 1870s?
Or before that, I mean, my proudest story about this, my new book, which I'm going to plug now shamelessly.
Please do.
Podcasts are for, is called A Brief History of Manga and is out on the 20th of June.
Okay.
And it's a very tiny book. It's an extremely short book, but it is one of the best historical surveys you're going to see. I don't believe in modesty unless it works for me.
Right. And there's no reason to because you're clearly available.
Yeah, I'm so available. And the other great thing about this book, it's both easy and cheap.
Okay.
That's my favorite bit of the songs of the great Dolly Parton. Apart from me and little Andy, which of course is untouchable.
Sure.
Is the wonderful line in Rhinestone. How many of you know that Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone starred together in a musical film?
Rhinestone.
Fabulous movie. And there's a wonderful line in a song that they do as a duet called Stay Out of My Bedroom, which goes, I may be easy, but at least I ain't cheap.
Okay. Wait.
This book is both easy and cheap.
And it's called A Brief History of Animals.
A Brief History of Manga.
Manga.
And it starts, there's a preamble with the stuff we've already discussed about the very early years and Adam Kern's discovery. But then it starts in 1861 when a young Englishman called Charles Wergman decides to move to Japan from China, where he's been a correspondent for the Illustrated London News. Because China's starting to get pretty safe and boring, you know, the Opium Wars are settling down, they aren't actually killing the English in such quantities anymore. And for a young newsman, it's not an exciting place to be. So Charlie moves to Japan with his commission from the Illustrated London News in his back pocket. But any of you who've ever worked journalism will know that a regular journalistic stipend is usually not what you wish it would be.
No. Yes. Livable wage is not what it is, really.
No, absolutely. Even in a country as cheap as Japan, which back then had had treaties forced on it by basically us, us and the rest of the European countries, that essentially said foreigners pay no tax and you virtually pay them to be in your country.
Huh.
So we were doing okay, but even so, Charles couldn't live the life of a young man about town on the wild frontier in what he was getting. So he thought, let's start some little businesses. And he started a business called Beato and Wergman Photographers with a mad Corsican Greek mate of his who ended up dying in Cairo in suspicious circumstances. And between them, they edited the way we all see Japan. Their photos, if you look back at their photos, and if you Google Beato, you'll find a lot of his photos.
How do you spell Beato?
B-E-A-T-O.
Okay.
Yeah. And if you Google that, you'll find that the vision of Japan that they set up in their photography is the way most of us still perceive Japan. Leaving out the cheap electronics and the yakuza.
Yeah, yeah.
Although they did have some yakuza in there in photos. It's very interesting. But that's, we're digressing, and we digress beautifully.
We do.
So he started this business, and then he thought, what else can I do? And he started a little magazine called the Japan Punch. And I envy the Japan Punch deeply, because it was just a little fanzine set up for the expat community, so they'd have something that they could read in English. But it was satirical, and nobody had done a satirical magazine in Asia before. And it was so successful that it sold right across Asia for 25 years till he discontinued publication. And it's fabulous. It's like reading Monty Python in Victorian times.
Wow!
And the Japanese got hold of this, obviously, because educated Japanese wanted to learn to speak English, wanted all this new stuff that was coming in, wanted to be able to swank to their neighbors about all the gossip that they knew about the English political delegations. So it started selling to the Japanese, and they thought, hang on, all this weird little scratchy line pictures and these satirical comments about rulers and politicians, we like this, we want a bit of this. And people started asking him if he would teach them the Western style of cartooning, which he began to. He introduced speech balloons.
Oh.
He introduced political cartoons. He introduced satirical cartoons, and thereby became the godfather of modern manga. And he also had another string to his bow. He was, like many, many Victorians, he was a very well-taught and very competent fine art painter. So he taught four or five of the greatest names in Japanese art how to paint in Western style.
Wow.
He began giving lessons. This guy was astonishing, but he was the father of manga, and the Japanese appreciate this so much that still, every year, on the anniversary of his death, they go to his grave in the Yokohama Foreign Cemetery, where he's buried, and both fine artists and manga artists come together to burn incense and pray for him. Because without Charlie Wergman, there would be a manga industry, because lots of other comic artists and comic cultures came into Japan. But without him, the manga industry would look different. And I like to think that that's because he started off, you know, with that British attitude, satire. Don't respect anything too much. Sarcasm.
Yeah.
Irony.
Yeah.
Stick two fingers up at the government. I mean, Charlie had been in the country like 10 years and people were already being jailed for political dissent. I think that's a measure of success.
Yeah, he's doing vital work. Holy smokes. That is the greatest story in the world.
He's wonderful. And so few people realize that. When I started studying anime manga back in 81, there was a general attitude that it was pretty low grade and, you know, not for mass consumption, not worth picking up on. And a few brave scholars changed that, people like Jessica Bowen Sugimoto and, of course, the great Fred Choate. But the general attitude was that you didn't really look at this too much. But there was also an attitude that because Japan had been cut off for 250 years till 1855, that Japanese culture in the 19th and 20th century was isolationist. It wasn't. The moment the doors were opened, the Japanese people wanted everything they could get from the rest of the world. Because like most of us, you know, new stuff is cool.
Right.
New stuff is really fun. And everybody wants to be a bit of an expert on something exotic. We know fans who wanted to be an expert on Japan. Well, they were just the same.
Yeah.
There were loads of Japanese people there in the 1860s who wanted to be able to say, oh, of course, you know how they do this in France. Oh, you don't? Let me explain.
That is awesome.
Yes. And so they wanted what we've got, and we wanted what they've got. There was a huge cultural interchange. The story of manga is not the story of a medium that developed in isolation, bursting on the West and changing everything. The story of Japan and manga is the story of a medium that developed as a result of a very rich, very ancient, very profound culture colliding with Western cultures and what happened as a result. And what happened both to the West and to Japan. But, of course, the Second World War was an enormous, great knife cutting down on most things in the world. And it distorted our views for a long time afterward. I grew up not being able to discuss Japan or anything Japanese in my house because my father, who hadn't actually fought in Asia himself, but had friends who had, and in fact had several friends who didn't come back from the Burma Railroad, absolutely hated the Japanese.
Right.
My father was a very gentle man who hated very few things in his lifetime, but he hated the Japanese from experience of his friends.
Right.
And so I didn't actually start studying Japan until quite late at school when I was given a project to do in history, and my history teacher had to write to my father and tell him that I must do this project.
He
was so adamant. And then, like everybody else, I just thought Japan was cherry blossom and samurai and geisha and cheap electronics.
Yep.
And it wasn't until I met Steve and started exploring anime and manga with him that I realized what a rich culture the whole of Japan is. So for me, anime and manga was a gateway into the heart of Japan. But I have to remember, and luckily I learned this from all the people I met along the way, that anime and manga was also a gateway opening out onto the West and letting Japan look at the West. So that's been wonderful. It's been a blast.
That's, you know, it's interesting too, because now I haven't read enough manga to know anything, but what I'm told is that it is at every, like you said, it's at every level of society.
Yeah.
So babies get it. It's the first, you know, it's like their little baby, the golden books.
Baby books, yes.
Baby books are manga, and so they're about animals and letters and,
yes,
you know, and life.
And feasts and days of the year and food stuffs, because all babies love food.
Babies love pictures of food.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
They're little selfies.
Yeah,
and then there's also, like, you know, like teen stories, and then there's a great deal of adult content.
Oh, yeah, there's manga specifically for retired people.
Just retired people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Manga about retired people, romance, drama, all sorts of stuff.
Oh, interesting. Sort of like Mingling Wrinkles kind of romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Kind of awesome.
Because
we're just starting to get into that in the movie industry. What I mean, there
Best
was a bunch.
Exotic Marigold Hotel, which
right?
I saw The Plane Coming Over, which is a fabulous movie about dying.
It is an amazing movie about dying if you get out there
and
and see some British people not die. Yeah. So, but then, I mean, so there's mystery manga, and there
are manga about everything. There's cookery manga. There's manga about playing mahjong. There's manga about electrical engineering. You can buy manga guides to statistics. You can buy a manga that teaches you to do calculus.
And it's drawings. It's essentially a graphic novel.
It's a graphic novel about calculus.
About calculus.
I don't say the plot is terrific.
Right.
It's very useful.
At the end of it, you have some information about calculus.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, and there are also manga based on all kinds of things about Western history. About American history, about European history. One of my favorites is an absolutely beautiful manga story called Emma, a Victorian Romance.
Okay.
And this is basically the story of an illiterate Victorian girl who's taken in as a maid by an ex-school teacher.
Sure.
And taught to read.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, immediately not only makes her overqualified for the work she's doing, but gives her what the Victorians would call ideas above her station.
Yes.
She learns to read and write, and as a result, her natural qualities of good nature and good humor and gentleness are allowed to blossom in the household she's working in. And she falls in love with the son of a very wealthy family, who also falls in love with her. And of course, this is completely unsuitable.
Yeah, that can't.
Yeah, and this manga is
That from my romance novel reading.
Absolutely. It never works. But not only is this happening in a beautifully researched setting that is magnificently accurate about everyday life. I mean, you could learn about Victorian history by reading Emma, just by observing the background. But it also includes a lot of the stuff that we've airbrushed out of that history because it doesn't suit us, like the fact that the Victorian Empire was a hotbed of racial tension and racial upheaval. Because, of course, Britain had an empire that spanned the world. Mm-hmm. So educated Indian princes, educated magnates from all corners of the globe, educated
from Africa,
were coming into Britain. And very often their parents had put together the gold of their country to send their children to a great British school. And they were coming into Britain, were magnificently educated, very cultured, spoke obviously at least two languages, mingling with a society which immediately said that, you know, wonderful as they might be and marvelous as they might be, you don't go around marrying white girls to guys with black skin. You guys had a similar thing in your own history, of course.
Oh, sure. Sure. There's still trouble.
Yeah. But, you know, it's all that is there in this manga, written by a Japanese lady who loves Victorian England.
And what is her name?
Her name, I can't remember.
Okay, but it's called...
I often forget names. It's called Emma, A Victorian Romance.
All right, and I can put that in the notes.
Yeah,
I'll look it up.
It's a magnificent story because it foregrounds the characters. It's foremost a story of love and personal development and coming to terms with your society. But it's packed with information, visual information, verbal information, story information, about Victorian England. And you look at this, and you could give this to any 14-year-old girl, and she would come out having learned about Victorian England by osmosis.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I know so many French people who know everything they know about the French Revolution through reading The Rose of Versailles.
Okay.
Yeah, which is another wonderful manga by Ryoko Ikeda.
Okay.
Which is the story of a cross-dressing girl swordsman.
Okay. The Rose of Versailles. I want to read that.
The Rose of Versailles, Versailles Nobara. It's fabulous.
Okay.
Essentially, Oscar is christened Oscar Francois by her father.
Okay.
Because she is his seventh daughter and he was desperate for a son and he knows he's not going to have any more because his wife is getting old. So, right. Seventh baby. This is a boy.
Okay.
He pretends that she's a boy, but she's brought up as a boy.
Right.
So she becomes, like Sapphire in Princess Knight, Osamu Tezuka's great manga, she becomes a great swordsman. And a great warrior, a great military commander, a great horseman, always a man. Nobody ever labels her woman, even though everybody knows she's a woman. Nobody ever considers her in the same way that they consider other women. She's considered on absolutely equal terms with the guys.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to court because that's what her noble father expects. And she becomes captain of the guard to the Dauphine, who at this stage is the lady who will later become Queen Marie Antoinette. And it's the story of the French Revolution and how Oscar, who is steeped in the best traditions of the French aristocracy, nobility, service, self-sacrifice, courtesy, gentility, good manners, comes to see that the corruption of everything that she holds dear is destroying her country and actually dies fighting for the Republican side.
Okay.
And it's beautiful. Magical.
And drawn amazingly.
Written beautifully, researched fabulously. Ikeda is a great historian. She did a manga about Catherine the Great.
Oh, wow.
Which is one of the most fabulous pieces of historical research.
Well, I think I've found a part of manga that I will be getting involved in.
Oh, and another one that you would love, although sadly it doesn't. Rose of Versailles does exist in translation.
Okay.
And so does Emma.
Okay.
But sadly, Ukinomonsho, the Seal of the King, doesn't exist in translation. It is one of the longest-running manga. It started in the 60s and it's still going.
Wow.
It's by a lady called Chieko Hosoda. And this is pure Mills and Boon, pure Harlequin romance. A young American girl called Carol falls back through a gap in time into ancient Egypt, where she becomes the beloved of the pharaoh. and of just about every other king of any country who comes into contact with her. Well, she is one hottie.
Right, and yeah. she's wanting to sleep with nobility.
Well, no, she's actually a very moral girl. She falls in love with her pharaoh. It's just, okay. You know, circumstances and so on.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, she jumps time backwards and forwards. Yeah.
Yeah. All through Egypt?
Yeah. Through Egypt and through several other cultures, but all in the same time era.
And all that thoroughly researched as well.
Like
the history
researched.
On it is amazing.
Yeah, but it's
But it's in Japanese.
It's in Japanese, but it's also a fabulous pulp romance. And again, I look at this and I think, why is this not a blockbuster TV series?
Yeah.
Because it is so made to be a blockbuster TV series.
Yeah.
Anyone knows anybody I can pitch to, just put me in front of them.
Okay.
It's fabulous.
Well, I get the Dork Forest. Yeah, I live in Van Nuys.
Mm-hmm.
It's Los
You're
Angeles.
Well placed, yeah.
Sure.
But there are Van so Nuys. Many stories. There are so many wonderful stories in manga that would make great TV and film properties.
Yeah.
But probably because most TV executives don't do a lot of reading anyway. And certainly don't do a lot of reading manga.
That feels mean and yet accurate.
Yeah.
Because they're all 23.
Well, believe me, most people nowadays don't do a lot of reading. Here in Dorkland,
yes.
We're different.
We are very different.
Yeah.
We are the spookiest of all reading peoples.
Yeah, very few people
We're creeping
average.
Everyone around us
very
at all
few
times.
People average more than 6 or 7 books a year. I mean, can you imagine only reading 6 or 7 books a year?
No.
How do these people get by?
Well, how do they deal with the voices in their heads?
Yeah, exactly.
I just got to calm everything down in there by
what
reading.
What do you do with their copious free time?
I know. They have so much free time. Because
yes.
Here's what I like to do. I like to have a book. I like to have a book I'm also rereading.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy having a Kindle opportunity
yes.
if I don't have a book with me. Mm-hmm. And I also like to listen to an audiobook sometimes as I drive.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, that means that I might have 4 or 5 books going at once.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm re-listening to the Audible. Like right now, I'm re-listening. So.
And the other thing, of course, is there's books for work as well. I mean, how do people ever do a job if they don't read books for work?
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, I read incessantly for work. I read as much as I can on anime, on manga, on popular culture, but also on history and on politics because it all feeds into the background.
Right.
But that's not reading. That's work reading.
That's work reading.
Yeah. So in an average year, most people I know, most people that I respect and consider intelligent, read between 100 and 150 books for fun, and maybe the same amount for work. Because if you don't read, you know, who are you?
But there's a lot of people who do read. They're like, they go down a rabbit hole in the internet.
Mm.
And because whenever I meet somebody who says, you know, I don't read, I always say, what do you mean you don't read? And then they tell me that they get like 2 magazines or they back to front on different blogs and different, you know, there's so much stuff on the internet that they're reading. And I tend to cut people some slack when they say that they don't read a lot of books and stuff. But what do you read for fun? What do you like? Are you reading James Patterson?
Oh, I love historical fiction.
Okay.
I love historical fiction. One of my favorites apart from the Divine Georgette is a lady called Dorothy Dunnett.
How do you spell Dunnett?
D-U-N-N-E-T-T.
Okay.
Now, Dorothy Dunnett was married to the editor of The Scotsman, one of our great ancient newspapers, Alistair Dunnett.
Okay.
And Dorothy Dunnett was a proud and passionate Scot who also had a deep appreciation of most of European history. And she started her career as a thriller writer. She wrote some very successful thrillers, including a great series called Dolly and the Nanny Bird. About a 1960s chick in swinging Britain who was a nanny and solved mysteries.
I'm reading those.
The series where I first met her and fell in love with her was her Limond Chronicles, which is the story of a young Scottish nobleman in Tudor times. The Tudor times that defeated our darling Georgette are completely the home of Dorothy Dunnett.
Okay.
These books are huge. It's a 6-part series, or as some people like to call it, a double trilogy.
Okay.
With a fat 350-page plus books.
Wow.
With casts of thousands. And the Limond saga ranges from Scotland all the way across to the north of Russia and Alaska, all the way back.
Wow. Covering
the whole of the politics of the time. And it is just epic. And at the heart of it is this astonishing love story.
Mm-hmm.
And with a bratty little kid, like a younger version of Phoebe in Sylvester.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sylvester's a Georgette Heyer novel. Yes.
And an even brattier, even more Sylvester-ish version of Sylvester.
Oh, of Sylvester.
As the hero.
Right. Sylvester, bossy Magoo. Super bossy. And then.
Super bossy, super noble, super clever, very good looking.
Yes.
The sort of person whose face you want to slap. Right. Until it brings him in contact with reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Because a little arrogant.
Yeah. And the love story is, of course, the making of both characters, but also a wonderful mystery around a very complicated Scottish family story that involves somebody marrying and then her husband being taken by the Corsairs and made to her as a galley slave and then marrying his son to keep her dowry in the family and then finding he wasn't dead after all.
Wow.
It gets very convoluted, but fabulous, fabulous books, beautifully written, loaded with history. I didn't really understand the history of the Muscovy Company and how we interacted with Tsar Ivan the Terrible until I read Dorothy Dunnett.
Right. And those are all words that I know are words. So I can't wait until I know about the Muscovies. And,
but you see, this is it. Reading stuff.
Yeah.
And the stuff that people turn their nose up at, historical fiction, romances, reading stuff makes you smarter.
It really does. Yeah. One of my favorite historical fiction novels that is written by one of the silliest authors to admit that you read publicly is Louis L'Amour.
Oh, wow.
He wrote a book called The Walking Drum. And The Walking Drum starts somewhere in the British Isles, and it goes through Africa and into India.
Yeah.
And it is... during the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages. And I read it in high school and I learned more about the Middle Ages than I had known about anything and than I had previously understood. So that was a great one. I do enjoy, I have recommended this on the show before. It is Daniel Day-Lewis's dad, Daniel Dad-Lewis. That's it. Daniel Dad-Lewis is what my friend Mike Kaplan calls him. But he wrote under the nom de plume Nicholas Blake.
Yes.
And he wrote a bunch of sort of pulpy mystery novels in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s before he became the poet laureate of the UK.
Well, you've got to make a living. And the one thing we know about poetry, and I am also a poet, is that you don't make a living.
Right. There's none. Yeah. He could not have been angrier to have written his first book, as Nicholas Blake, because the first third of the first mystery of the Nicholas there, Nigel Strangeways is the name of his Agatha Christie character. And, before we meet Nigel Strangeways, he is furious that he's writing a mystery novel. And all the first third of the book is him making fun of mystery novels. Yeah. And then he introduces Nigel Strangeways, and then he falls in love with his own character. And then 14 books later, he's like, now this guy's a genius. It's great.
Yeah, we do that. And that, of course, became a great trope of crime fiction. Going all the way through into TV, there is a wonderful British series, minor but wonderful, called Department S that was made just after The Avengers.
I don't know
how many of you know Department S, but Department S is about one
70s?
Of those government, yeah.
Okay.
Late 60s.
Okay.
Well, the government super departments that set up to solve all the mysteries that those flat-footed plods at the yard are still too dumb to solve years after Sherlock Holmes showed them how. Mm. But Department S has, as a special consultant and occasional visitor, the most deliciously camp creation in the swinging 60s, Jason King.
Yes.
Now, Jason King is a dandy of the First Order. He shoots his cuffs to show you his lace. He wears high pointed collars that button down. He always believes in being perfectly dressed.
Very nice.
He lives in Paris. And Jason King is a crime novelist. Jason King has created a character called Mark Kane, with whom he is also totally in love. Because Mark Kane is Jason, but without the pratfalls and the comic bits that Jason does all the time. And his question always is, what would Mark Kane do?
Wow. That is the most meta.
How he lives his life.
Oh, that is awesome.
It's even more meta than that because the actor who played Jason King, the great, great Peter Wingard, one of Britain's most fabulous actors, was, while he was playing this wonderfully uber-heterosexual character, who was voted, incidentally, by Australian girls as the man they would most like to lose their virginity to in 1970. Although, presumably, not the whole of Australia at once, because in one year, that would have been a bit much.
Are you about to tell me that they were also, that was not to be resolved?
It was not to be resolved because Peter Wingard has been, as my old history teacher, a very respectable nun in her 70s, used to say, bent as a nine bob note.
Fantastic. Welcome to the Dork Forest, where sayings from 1967 are still being said.
Well, no, that's slightly pre-1967, because I was in school sometime before that.
But, oh, fair enough.
Bent as a nine bob note is a very old English bit of slang for someone who's gay.
Right.
And not bent in the sense of being criminally bent.
No. No. It's a, he hangs to the left.
Yeah.
All right. So,
or the right,
whatever. Gentlemen, yeah. Check your pants. Okay. So, all right.
Metafictions just go through all kinds of fictional culture. And I find that completely fascinating.
Yeah. I love, you know, I mean, the thing, what I love, your love of reading is so great because what I like about fiction is that it can teach us how to live our lives. Mm. And it can give us a way out of like hard situations, like moral situations where you're like, I don't know how I would respond to that. And you're like, well, what Han Solo would do is, and then you would, it could be science fiction. So you can have moral issues, but nobody's going to get mad because you're not talking about the NRA. You're talking about a version of the NRA, but it's in 2477 and everyone has ray guns. Yeah. So. Yeah,
and this is what one thing that anime does very well with Britain, because as you've probably observed, we have quite a lot in common with Japan. We're a small island empire.
Okay.
We have a very ancient monarchy. We have an established state religion, which very few people actually belong to, but everybody pays lip service to.
Mm-hmm.
We are a very traditional country that places a very high value on courtesy and on consideration for others and on respect, and we drink tea.
Okay.
We are Japan's logical mirror. And so Japan uses Britain as a metaphor for all kinds of things. It's one of those European dream places that are cited right through anime. I mean, the K-On! Movie, for example, when they go on their big trip. They could have gone to L.A., they could have gone to Vegas, but they're nice high school girls, and nice high school girls don't go to L.A. and Vegas. They go to London.
Okay.
Yeah, the K-On! Movie.
K-On! Movie?
Yeah. K-On! Is a very popular anime series based on a four-panel gag strip manga.
Yeah?
And K-On! Is about essentially a girl band, none of whom have any talent, but who are all super as a band.
Together
they create something remarkable. They pull in a girl who has never played the guitar in her life, and she turns out to be a natural.
So often happens.
I mean, how many times has somebody said to you, hey, you can play the guitar, can't you? And then suddenly you pick it up and you know what? You can.
You can.
Yeah.
Why?
Amazing.
It would be the best if that was something that could just happen.
Yes, it would be fun. Although I don't know, sometimes I think the process of learning, I don't laugh, but I did ballet when I was much younger. One reason why I gave it up was that I learned through a series of fairly complicated medical tests that they can do that I was one of the few people in the world who was never actually going to grow tall enough for classical ballet.
Oh, really?
The optimum height is 5'6" on point.
Okay.
And I wouldn't quite make that. And also, of course, my body type isn't right for classical ballet. So they said to my mother, and my mother relayed it to me much more brutally than they really relayed it to her. She's just not got the body type to get beyond the corps de ballet. So however good a dancer she is, however great a dancer she is, it's corps or classical or character parts, and that's it. And for me, if I couldn't be the swan queen,
you didn't want to do it. So when did your mom tell you that?
I was 9.
Oh, good. I'm glad she waited.
Yeah. it was the right time because once you hit 9, you start doing point work. Very few teachers will teach you point work before 9 or 10.
Okay.
Because your feet haven't developed far enough to be broken and bloodied.
Oh, fair enough.
And point work is hell. Point work really is hell. So many of my friends who went on with ballet.
Yeah.
You spend all your time darning the fresh patches into the inside of your shoes because your feet bleed into them all the time. You spend most of your time with a broken toe one way or another. Dancers' feet, if you ever look at dancers' feet, ballet dancers' feet, they are incredibly deformed.
I don't want to see them now.
It's pretty horrific. It's like the equivalent of foot binding. But instead of letting you do it on a very curved and much truncated foot, they make you leap with the whole body weight on the points of your toes and land.
And then just land.
Repeatedly. Over an hour and a half of a ballet.
And it isn't the shoe. They don't create just, why not just create a shoe that has a flat and then...
Well, there is a shoe that has a flat toe, but your foot still has to land inside of it.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. It still breaks your foot. Yeah. Okay.
Actually, very few ballerinas break the upper bones in their foot because the way the foot arches and the tension that takes it, unless you're unlucky enough to have your foot go flat, which creates problems, mostly the upper bones don't break, but the toe bones break just from impact. Yeah. So, ballet, torture, what can we say?
What can you say? Here, what I would say is I would like to ask now the elephant in the room, which is manga cross stitch.
Manga cross stitch. I am a stitcher. I am totally.
There is embroidery. And Helen McCarthy, ladies and gentlemen, has written a book with a gentleman. Did you write it with?
No, I wrote manga cross stitch all alone.
By yourself?
By myself. The books I wrote with a gentleman are about anime, and we'll come on to that. And also how far I can be called a gentleman.
Oh, fair. But what about, or did someone else provide some of the patterns, but you did most of the patterns?
No, I did all the patterns.
All the patterns? What's the name of the book? I'm so sorry.
Manga cross stitch is my partner did some of the designs for
me.
Because art, I was taught to draw well enough to know that I don't draw all that.
There's a point where we all go, oh, I can just do Snoopy, and then we're done.
Also, I mean, in the old North of England parlance, why keep a dog and bark yourself? And my other half is a superb artist.
Okay.
So I said to him, I need some designs for this book. What we were trying to do was so many manga cross-stitch patterns, anime cross-stitch patterns, are based on licensed properties that are just ripped off. And as a writer myself and partner of an artist, I don't like to see people ripping off other artists. It's not fair. Doing an homage, doing your own thing is fair enough. But selling somebody else's work on the internet when you just put it into a charting engine, that's not nice.
No.
So I thought, let's show people how easy it is to do this yourself and to unleash your own creativity just by understanding how the visual grammar of manga works, understanding how stitching works, and bringing the two together. So we did the book as a project to do that, and I workshop it still in various places at various conventions.
It's the greatest idea in the world.
It's a good idea, and I've seen some beautiful work from it, and I'm really, really proud of that book. But the problem with working with an artist, as any of you who've ever done it know, is that they are such fussy bastards. They really are. Steve.
I'm nodding.
Now, Steve is someone who does beautiful work, but like most artists, he likes to use curves. And when you're working in counted thread needlework, which exists on grids like pixels, curves are not your friend.
Right.
Curves are so not your friend.
Right.
So it was an interesting compromise because he'd give, what happens when you design is very few people design straight onto a canvas or straight onto the grid. Most people draw and then take it into the grid. I like to design directly on the grid because that lets me control the whole flow of it better. If you're taking something from a non-gridded environment into a pixel environment, you get automatic mismatches. So what would happen is I would scan in his beautiful designs, and he would stand over my shoulder telling me why I was getting the chart wrong, until I hit him with something large and heavy and worked at it for a bit. And then when he regained consciousness, he'd say, hey, that looks great. What did you do with it?
Yes. And what did you do to it? I mean, he couldn't be doing all Minecraft.
It takes an awful lot of tweaking. It really does. And experimentation and patience.
Yeah, because it's got to be a lot of square jaws and a lot of, you know.
Essentially, you're moving pixel by pixel.
Wow.
Tiny elements of a picture till it all comes into line.
Okay.
And then you're scaling it so that it doesn't lose too much of the curvature, but it can be stitched at a reasonable size. Because you've got to remember that doing cross-stitch, you're working on single blocks, each with an X of thread inside it. Now, you can't make those too tiny because people have to stitch them.
Right.
But the larger you make them, the more distortion you get.
Okay.
So it's not always fun. But
it's just like pixels, but with thread.
Just like pixels, but with thread. Exactly.
All right.
Or like that beadwork that you see people do, but with thread.
Right. And then when you back up against it, you can see the big picture.
Exactly. Well, you can see the big picture. You can see the small picture fairly well if you do it small enough. But I'm for the first time ever, because I've stitched since I was like 3 years old.
Okay.
But for the first time in my life, I'm going to sell some work. Or I'm going to show some work. I hope I'm going to sell some work at Worldcon this year.
Okay. At Worldcon.
Worldcon.
Where is that?
The London, the World Science Fiction Convention is being held in London from the 14th to the 19th of August this year.
Okay.
It's called LunCon 3. And yeah, it's my local convention. I don't have to pay an airfare to get there. It's in my town.
Right.
So I thought, let's just be brave and see if I can sell something here. So I've got some of my stitched art going in there and some of my haiku art going in there. And that should
be that's
fun.
Great. And then do you have published poetry work that you want to tell people about?
I don't have published poetry work. I do tweet poetry, and I've done two poetry books on Smashwords, one of which is raising a trickle of money for the Tsunami Fund.
Oh, good.
But I am hoping to put together a poetry anthology if I can find a publisher. Haiku is not the most popular form in Britain for publication.
Right.
But, you know, we're working on it. We'll get there in the end.
Sure. And it's TweetHeart4711.
Yes.
Yes. Indeed. On Twitter. And
my blog, which is Helen McCarthy, A Face Made for Radio.
A Face Made for Radio. I saw that.
Yeah, and which you can find on WordPress.
Right. Yeah, that's a WordPress. And this has been fascinating. And
it still is.
It still is. We have 4 minutes, I've been told, from the nice man in the hat.
In 4 minutes.
In 4 minutes, we should.
I've had some of the worst sex of my life in 4 minutes.
That would do it.
Yeah.
First of all, that's the 4 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah. You're just like, I'm going to need some more prep. Either solo time alone prior to this engagement, possibly after you're done, you go get a sandwich.
Yeah,
I'll meet
really
you in a
useful thing about rugby teams.
Yes.
There are 15 of them.
Oh, I will say, what was I going to tell? What story was I going to let people in on? Oh, I know. Your mom was 9. My dad waited till we were 12 to talk to us because he's a button pusher, and so he never had anything positive to say. And if you say anything, if you try to button push a child under the age of 12, it doesn't stick, and you just have a crying child. So he would, at the age of 12, he would start saying things like, he would pick fights. He's like, you got to learn how to argue. And, so he would say things like, poor people should be killed. Discuss. And, dictatorships keep people busy, right? And, and then you'd have to hold forth and try to defend yourself on, you're like, well, that seems mean. And he's like, don't be ridiculous. What else? And,
that never happened in my family because my family is Irish and we were arguing from the cradle. Everybody in my family talks all the time.
You have definitely been plug and play. I've been very pleased with this interview.
Oh, I'm
this has
so
been
fun.
You get a free T-shirt. You get a Dork Forest T-shirt.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you enjoy a T-shirt.
I like hoodies.
All right. Well, then you will enjoy. You get a. I brought some T-shirts. I also have my CD and DVD if you want them. Tomorrow night here at AnimeCon, I'm doing a stand-up show called "This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux."
Oh, brilliant.
Yes, and that's tomorrow in the middle of the night. It's at like 11:30, I think, upstairs at the Metropolitan. And AnimeCon, I now am even more now than ever, because I read a lot of comic books, but I've never read manga.
Oh, so, wow. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, but from left to right?
It's the exact same thing. Well, most manga are still done from left to right, because you know what artists are? They absolutely hate being flipped. And the reason for that is that how most artists see if there's a flaw in their work is they hold it up to a mirror. And so if you try and flip an artist's work and present it that way, they feel as though you're showing everybody their defects all the time. When the great Torrin Smith did Blade of the Immortal, he actually cut and repasted printed galleys to get the whole thing running in the proper order.
Yeah, I'm going to have you back on.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Helen McCarthy, please, thank you so much for doing this show.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?